Welcome to Sleep Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios with Elizabeth Spires of the New York Times.
Hello.
With my colleague Emily Peck of Axios.
Hi.
We have a great show this week. The big business and finance news of the week is all of the crazy stuff going on around TikTok, which the House may or may not have voted to ban. We are going to talk about that, but that's not even the first segment. We are going to talk about liquid death and branding water and how branding water is now worth $1 billion. And that's not even the first segment. We are going to have a whole other segment, which is the first segment, about whether work is mid and how work is just doesn't have the same attraction that it used to pre-pandemic. It's a great show. We have a Slate Plus for the ages with Shayna Roth, all about tanning. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Emily Peck, if you were a Gen Zer, would you be of the opinion that work is mid?
Yes, absolutely. I would think work was mid. I would think there's better things in life to do than work all day, and that I should only do as much as I need to do to sort of get paid. Perhaps I would think that.
So is this the end of ambition and hustle culture?
Absolutely not. No. But there is something going on, Felix. Something going on.
What is going on? Tell me what is in the water. What is the thing that we are drinking?
There are many work trends happening simultaneously, so it's hard to have an umbrella theory of the case. But gotta hand it to Greg Ip in the Wall Street Journal. He sure tries. He contends that Americans don't care as much about work anymore. And I think he's not wrong. And there's a few things going on. Obviously, the big thing was COVID, and I think it allowed the changes, especially for remote work in COVID, allowed some higher earners, especially men, it turns out, to choose to work less and to have this like epiphany of, oh, if I don't have to commute every day, if the workplace is more flexible, I can like do more stuff that's not work related during the day. I can live my life. I can be a human being in a new way that I couldn't before. At the lower end, something else interesting is going on, I think. I wrote about this a few weeks ago from some ADP data. They're the paycheck company. They looked at their data and they found people are working less for different reasons. But one reason was because hourly workers are making more money, so they don't need to work as many hours to make the money anymore. And so some of them might also be choosing to work less.
So this is two sides of the same coin, which is something I wrote about in my book when I was writing about Keynes and his projection that right around now, everyone would be so rich that we'd only need to work 3 or 4 hours a week. And his economic projections of basically GDP per capita and income per capita were pretty much spot on. He extrapolated forward, 75 years, whatever it was, to today, and he got it right. He got our wealth and our income right. And he's like, we have a sort of human societal need to do something. We don't like to just laze around and do nothing all the time. But once we've worked 3 or 4 hours a week, we basically scratched that itch. And then we will have a perfectly decent standard of living on that kind of amount of work, and then people won't work any more than that. And what happened is that for many decades after that, the amount of work people did was flat to a little bit up, and the standard of living just exploded. And we wound up becoming much more, you know, we wound up moving into bigger houses, you know, consuming much more, and generally just like given the opportunity to work more and get more versus work less and get less. We, you know, as a society, we chose the former. We worked more and got more. And, you know, still one of my favorite episodes of this show was when we had Daniel Markovitz in from Yale talking about how the sons and daughters of the elite, the kind of people who go to Yale Law School, just work insanely hard. They work insanely hard before they get to law school. They work insanely hard in law school. And then they work insanely hard for like many decades after they graduate from law school in the service of making just enormous amounts of money, most of which ultimately they just kind of winds up sitting in a bank account and getting inherited by their children, you know? And that ambition and drive was something that Keynes didn't expect. And I think that you're right, that the pandemic kind of broke that. And people woke up one morning, you know, if you're a partner at a law firm in 2021 and you have been making, you know, seven figures for the past 20 years and you have more than enough money to live a very comfortable life for the rest of your life, you kind of wake up and you're like, you know, I am just, is this what I should be doing with my life? Is this the best thing I can do with my life? Can I just work much less and live where I want to live and live how I want to live and enjoy life instead of just chasing after an extra marginal dollar that does nothing for me? And conversely, yeah, as you say, at the bottom of the income spectrum, people are like, you know, I was actually perfectly happy when I was earning $12 an hour. Now I'm earning $20 an hour.
Wow.
You know, but they're like teens, you know, and they're like, if I'm earning $20 an hour, I need to work fewer hours in order to be able to like fulfill my needs.
I think there are a couple of other dynamics there too, particularly when you're talking about people who grew up in wealthy families and they end up working more. A lot of times that's not really about ambition, it's about status maintenance. And I think the pandemic upended a lot of that. It upended the way that, you know, we think about work. You know, in American culture in particular, work is heavily tied to people's identity, the way that they think about themselves. But it's easier to kind of maintain what's sometimes an illusion that work is important when you're sitting in an office for 40 hours a week surrounded by other people who are doing the same kind of work. When you're sitting at home and there's a global pandemic and your kid is in the next room, it really, I think, caused a lot of people to examine the actual work they were doing, how meaningful it was, how much of your life you actually spend doing that. I mean, you know, sometimes it seems sort of absurd to me that we're supposedly the most highly evolved species and we spend so much of our waking lives sitting in front of a screen, mostly doing things that are not particularly meaningful. The average knowledge worker is spending a lot of time doing things that are kind of tedious, don't add any, you know, incremental value to an individual's life. And you do it because you need to eat, you need to pay for healthcare, you know, all these things. And it just seems suboptimal, or at least probably not what Keynes imagined when he was thinking about what work would look like in the future.
Yeah. There's also two like reality check things that are worth noting. First is that work hours have been declining for years and years and years. Like people have been working less, and that's been steadily happening in the background in most rich countries. It's not to 3 to 4 hours a week, obviously, but it has been declining as productivity has gone up.
And something like the pandemic, the reason it was able to have such a profound change was precisely because it had that tailwind.
Mm-hmm. It was a pre-pandemic trend ongoing. And the other thing that could be happening now leading people to work less, especially again at the low end, I know I just said some people at the low end might be choosing to work less. Well, some people at the low end are forced to work less, because another thing that's happening right now is employers might be hoarding workers. In other words, they're afraid to let people go and fire them or lay them off because it's a tight labor market and they don't necessarily know if they can hire people back very easily. So they're holding on to labor that they don't want to pay them as much. They want to like cut back on labor costs. So they're giving them fewer hours. And one example, right now, there's a lawsuit in New York against Starbucks because Starbucks allegedly has been cutting hourly workers' hours. And the hourly workers say, like, you know, I was working 35 hours a week, 40 hours a week. but now you've cut me back to 20. I don't want to just work 20. I want to work 35. I can't even afford my rent anymore. So there are some people for whom they can't get enough hours. You know what I mean? Probably there was a psychological shift, but there's all other kinds of noise, you know, happening at the same time.
There is something else interesting happening in that, like, one of the great achievements of the labor movement in, you know, the post-war and even pre-war era was this conception of the 40-hour week. The 40 hours was like the right number of hours to work on some kind of like great platonic ideal. And employers were not happy about this because historically they would make people work much more than that for their weekly wages. And then the unions came in and they're like, no, 40 hours is how much people should work. And in the intervening decades, as you say, there has been this long-term trend of people working fewer hours per week. And now, very, very slowly, 32 seems to be the new 40.
Oh, have you been listening to Bernie, Felix?
Well, I've been listening to Bernie and I've been looking at France and I've been looking at the UK and I've been looking at what, like, Sean Fain suggested in part of his UAW negotiations. He was like, we should have a 32-hour week, which is not, by the way, necessarily our workers should not work any more than 32 hours, but it's anything above that is extra. And, you know, you'd start getting overtime and stuff above 32. The 32, now, I remember in the early days of the fight for the $15 minimum wage, you know, when it was $7 and it was like, move it to 15. Mm-hmm. It felt like a kind of stretch goal. But mm-hmm. then we got there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like 32 hours could be one of those things that it's like, right now it feels kind of, you know, extreme and fringe. But it's cropping up in enough places, enough of the time that it might catch on.
Yeah, and this past week, Bernie Sanders introduced this 32-hour work week act. He had Sean Fain, the UAW president, who tried to get 32 hours in the contract at the hearing.
And I think it's a function of getting people adjusted to the idea that productivity isn't going to necessarily go down if you reduce the work week. And when the work week went from 6 days to five, there was a lot of backlash that's similar to the critiques you're seeing now that said, you know, particularly from big bosses who thought that it would make people lazier or less productive. And so you're seeing the same line of critique that happened in the 40s and 50s when that shift happened.
And one of the things you said, which is really important, is that a lot of the move to the 40-hour work week was, it was kind of standardized on 8 hours a day, and it moved from 6 days a week to 5 days a week. And now the 32-hour work week is also standardized on 8 hours a day and moving from 5 days a week to 4 days a week. The hours a day doesn't seem to change. What changes is the number of days that you're not working. And this is one of my favorite statistics, going back to 2011 when there was the big economic crisis in Greece. And Germany was basically the creditor country and Greece was the debtor country. And the Germans were like, oh my God, you lazy Greeks, you don't work and you expect us to pay for you and bail you out. And then if you looked at the number of hours worked per year by Germans and by Greeks, the Greeks were working like twice as many hours as the Germans, almost like a lot more. And it's not that they worked more hours a day, but they just worked many more days a year. And the Germans are constantly on holiday. They all get, like, you know, 7 weeks of vacation every year and they take them all. And then they also have a million holidays and days off and all the rest of it. And the number of actual days they work is tiny.
That was one of the things Jared, our wonderful producer, put in our research. It was like work hours have gone down. And a lot of that is like paid vacations, sick days, holidays, things that we didn't necessarily have like 100 years ago at work that are now like expected and understood to be happening.
Another factor, I was just reading Cal Newport's new book, Slow Productivity. He makes the point that for knowledge work, it's very often difficult to really quantify how much time you spend working because so much of it is, you know, particularly with big intractable problems or, you know, big creative projects, it's hard to really put a box around how you do the work. And that's become more clear when people are working from home, you know, and for those of us who do things like, you know, for writers, you know, it's when do you stop working there? If you're constantly reading and, you know, thinking about things and you know, working on the project in your head, the idea of sort of boxing those kinds of jobs into 40 hours a week doesn't make sense in the first place. And, you know, when you look at measures of productivity around those jobs, just being in an office for 40 hours a week seems utterly beside the point.
Yeah. And that's where the pandemic comes in as like finally disrupting that situation and that arrangement. It's like, it wasn't really working before. The idea that you go in, you sit at your desk for 8 hours for the day, and like you come up with all your ideas and bang out, and then you're done. Like, that wasn't how it was working anyway. So then to be like set free from that, people could just work at their own, theoretically, at their own sort of like natural pace and rhythms.
Or in silence, which is important for some of us.
But also, I think this is what we're discovering, right? And this is Greg's thesis, and I think it's probably true, that left to our own devices, if we work at our own pace and rhythm, there's a good chance that that natural pace and rhythm is slightly slower, slightly more self-indulgent, slightly less productive than, you know, if we have some evil corporate taskmaster like standing over us with a whip saying, work more, you know, like, it's more pleasant, but it's also lazier. You know, I spent 3 months in Ireland writing a book, and on one level, like, I was writing that book 24 hours a day. It was basically all I was thinking of. But on another level, there was the actual physical amount of time I spent typing the words in that book was not that great, you know?
Well, but do you think you could have written it in 3 months in an office? Like, I think it's another one of those things where it's like, well, how are you measuring productivity in that instance? You know, because a lot of what you would do in an office would be things like check-in meetings or, you know, tedious administrative stuff. Is that really just... is that working more, or is it just adding, you know, busyness that looks like work, but doesn't actually produce anything?
Yeah, I think people underestimate the importance of bureaucracy. Like, bureaucracy exists for a reason, and we all find it incredibly annoying. There's no one who likes it, you know? But if you could have a super productive company without lots of layers of management, then that would exist, and it doesn't.
One thing we haven't mentioned, it's the AI elephant in the room.
The AI elephant?
You know, I've been sitting here trying to think of how to say it for the past 5 minutes. But yeah, the AI elephant. AI is going to really change, I think, productivity, work hours, all of it. I mean, the idea that everyone wants to work less is coming at a really good time, because I do think eventually maybe AI will enable us to work less. Although that's probably what people thought about .com.
If AI makes us more productive, which I think there's a very good chance it will.
Totes.
That's just going to make us more productive. And you know, productivity is going to go up. And productivity is going to go up by, you know, multiply it by the number of hours worked. And maybe the number of hours worked might go down a little. But we're going to have this Keynesian thing happen again, where people work just as much and they just become much more productive and we become a much richer country. Yay.
Or the capitalist bosses are like, you don't need to work as much, therefore we will pay you less.
Millions of wage earners released from starvation wages and excessive hours of labor. The pattern of a new order of industrial relations is definitely taking shape.
Before we get to the break, let me tell you about our Slate Plus segment this week. We're going to be talking about tanning with our longtime producer, Shayna Roth. Apparently, being tan is all the rage again, and Shane is going to get into it. We learned all about this from this great Washington Post article that was out this week. So yeah, Slate Plus members will get to hear that at the end of the show. And if you're not a Slate Plus member, you should sign up. With Slate Plus, you get to hear great segments like the one I was just talking about with Shayna. You also don't have to hear ads on any podcasts. And you get a lot of other great Slate stuff. You get unlimited access to all of the stuff on slate.com. There's a members-only newsletter. And of course, there's our bonus segment every week. So sign up at slate.com/plus. That's slate.com/plus.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fracturing me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let's talk about hydration because, Emily, you have a glass of water in your hand. We are recording this on a video and I can see your glass of water. And that water, I'm assuming, came out of the tap at a marginal cost of zero. Elizabeth Spires has a can of water, Polar Seltzer, which presumably you bought at some kind of a supermarket at a marginal cost of what, like 75 cents?
Probably, yeah.
My hydration this morning is my beloved Sojirushi coffee mug with coffee that was made with water out of the tap, but also coffee beans that were shipped to me from upstate New York. We are all just drinking stuff all day. When we're on podcasts, when we're off podcasts, there's just a huge amount of general hydration going on. But the branding of what we drink is, I think, it's still in its infancy in a weird way. You know, like the people who drink 47 cans of Diet Coke a day, like they are definitely drinking a very branded drink. But beyond fizzy sodas, most of the stuff that we drink isn't particularly branded and hasn't really been part of that great marketing revolution that has transformed the planet over the past 50 years. And the news hook here is Liquid Death just raised another round at $1.4 billion valuation. And Liquid Death is a water company and they sell water in cans. And their great innovation is they sell water in cans. Well, they basically sell marketing. They sell an image. They've created this very indelible brand. Everyone knows who they are, what they stand for, what they do. They, you know, started with still water and then they branched out into carbonated water. And now they're branching out into various other kind of, you know, flavored waters and stuff. But it's water in a can, and it's water in a can for the 21st century of, like, what I care about is image and color and brand and identity. And I can express something about who I am by the brand of the water that I drink. And much more than, like, there was always something kind of fey and elitist about, you know, I'm going to import water from France. I'm going to drink Evian water. It's like, oh, fuck off, you know? Whereas Liquid Death doesn't do any of that, like, our water is better bullshit. It doesn't say, like, yeah, our water comes from some, you know, spring in the French Pyrenees. It just says, like, it's fucking water. That's what it is. Water is water, but we're going to add a bunch of branding to it. And I love the honesty, and I think it's great that they have a $1.4 billion valuation.
Well, I also sort of, I'm a sucker for the marketing. I kind of love it. I'm sure most people have probably seen the Tall Boy Liquid Death cans, and they have a sort of melting skull on them, and they're called Liquid Death. But they also do these kind of promotions that definitely appeal to a specific demographic. They sold a kit called the Travis Barker Enema of the State Collectible Kit that included a Liquid Death branded enema bulb and a can autographed by Travis Barker. And the copy on it says something like, enema of the state should never be placed in or near your butthole without consulting a doctor first. And that's the sort of vibe of the brand. They had an Arnold Palmer kind of product that they renamed Dead Billionaire after the Palmer estate threatened to sue them. So it is just water, but it's got a sort of punk goth vibe that I think particularly appeals to young people who are transitioning away from, you know, drinking alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, and the company said it was sort of inspired by alcoholic brands because they shouldn't be the only ones to, like, have fun and, like, do goofy ads and stuff like that. Like, to expand on what Felix said about soda companies, you know, really owning marketing and branding, in a way that, you know, our water that we drink or his coffee from upstate doesn't really get there. Alcohol definitely does. Like,
it's
everyone
all
is,
branding. Yeah.
Vodka is all branding. Yeah. Craft beers are like funny, or like they try to be cute with the names or whatever. So now Liquid Death is trying to do that with water, which sort of like gives it like pulls the curtain down from so much of this stuff. It's just, it's pure marketing. It's just water. All it is, you're just buying a decoration for yourself. That's, you know what I mean? It's like hydration jewelry or something.
And what I love about it is that, you know, if you tell a boomer this, they will be offended. You know, they'll be like, why would I pay for marketing? But if you tell a cynical Gen Xer this, or anyone younger, they'll be like, well, of course I'm paying for marketing. That's what you pay for. You know, like, this is why I want to spend $250 on a pair of sneakers. It's because of the marketing. It's because of the color they are. It's because of like what people think when they see me. It's because what I am projecting when I am seen with this. Liquid Death, one of the things that it really, like the place where it really started and gained its first big foothold in the beverage market, is in clubs and bars and openings. And like, if you're hanging out in the evening with a bunch of people who are drinking cocktails or drinking beers, you don't want to sit there with a plain glass of water. You want to hold something that is branded and cool and like, yeah. And there's no stigma any longer associated with the idea that you're not drinking alcohol, but you still want to be drinking something. And drinking Liquid Death allows you to drink water and drink something at the same time. I think it's genius.
It's just... The advertisers and the marketers have completely won. Like once upon a time, we saw them marketing to us and we were like, ew. Now people see it and are like, yay. Like, it's really, really crazy. It's a real...
I used to drink Red Stripe beer quite a lot just because they had this great marketing and it was like, and the slogan was hooray beer. And I'm like, that's such a great slogan.
It's just such a capitulation to capitalism. It's like, well, this is what it is, and I'll go with it.
I think people feel more affection for brands whenever they sort of build entertainment into the branding. So if it's fun, if it makes you laugh, you know, people are less willing to look at it as cynical marketing.
But that's what it is, isn't it? Like, we're saying like, oh, this brand is so cool. It's like, they're just trying to make a bunch of money.
Of course, like, they're making the... Of course. But
they're
like,
they're not selling anything useful, really. I mean, I guess
it is very useful. And at the margin, it causes people to drink less alcohol. So that's also good.
That's fair. I guess if it's giving people a cover to not drink alcohol where they might feel pressured to drink alcohol.
Or making it even at the margin, possibly, dare I say it, cooler to not drink alcohol than to drink alcohol. You know, then at that point, you've won.
Well, or to not drink sodas, too, which I think is somebody who has a slightly goth-oriented eight-year-old. You know, he picked up a can of Liquid Death over picking a soda a while back whenever I said he could have a treat. And I was perfectly happy with that. You know, I'd vastly prefer my child drinking seltzer than soda.
Also, there's this thing of like taking stuff that should theoretically be free or very low cost, like public resources such as water, air, and selling them back to people for a lot of money is just, I think it's
capitalism
leading us down a path of depletion. I mean, many years ago, I think I wrote about like all these like lawsuits and protests for Coca-Cola, who will take, you know, water from these poor developing countries and use it to make drinks. And then people don't have water in the country, stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, but this is not a zero sum. It's like, Liquid Death is not reducing the amount of free water available to anyone.
It's further promoting the idea that water should cost a lot of money, which it definitely shouldn't. You know what I mean? It's a public resource, and I don't want anyone...
No, I think the reason people like to drink it is precisely because it is a choice. It is discretionary spending. You walk into a bar, you can ask for a glass of water and they'll give it to you for free, or you can ask for a can of Liquid Death and they'll give it to you for $5. And it's up to you which one you do. And if you prefer to spend $5 on a Liquid Death, that is because that is the kind of spending that people want to do, and they're getting $5 of value out of it somehow.
Have either of you tasted?
I have.
How is it?
It's water.
In the civilian world, you accepted water. It was there. You got used to drinking good water, pure water. Did you ever wonder how it got that way?
seeing as how this is the business and finance news of the week, we do need to talk about the latest in the TikTok ban, which may or may not be a ban and may or may not happen. And if it does happen, may or may not result in TikTok being taken over by Steve Mnuchin, which is just amazing.
I can't believe we're talking about Mnuchin again this week.
I know. Like, it's that man again, as they say in England. Whenever he sees something that he can buy up on the cheap, he's like, let me do that. I have a bunch of Middle Eastern money backing me and I can buy it up. I guess we should start with the bill, which passed the House virtually unanimously. Like, the, on both sides of the aisle, basically said, yeah, let's pass this bill saying that ByteDance has to sell TikTok US within 180 days. And if it doesn't, then it'll be banned in America and no one can use it. And it is now headed to the Senate, and it is not at all clear that the Senate will pass this bill. Elizabeth, you're the person here who understands American politics. I sure don't. Explain to me how a bill that is popular with both Democrats and Republicans in the House would be much less popular with Democrats or Republicans in the Senate.
Well, the Senate tends to be more professionalized. They tend to have more experience in politics. They're more likely to just collectively understand the implications of a bill or the difficulty of implementing something that has to be done within 180 days if it passes, which is what the House bill says. ByteDance would have to divest TikTok within 180 days. And we all know that that's a very slow process ordinarily. The House tends to be made up of people who have less experience in Congress on the whole, and they just don't always anticipate the larger structural difficulties of doing some of these things.
And so I think this is the first question that we need to sort of struggle with here, is whether or not it is sensible or useful to think of this as an attempted TikTok ban. I think the people who support the bill will say, this is not a ban. We just want it to be sold. And the minute, and you don't even need to sell very much of it. Like right now, TikTok is like 40% owned by ByteDance and Chinese employees. And the bill says that needs to come down to below 20%. So they only really need to sell like 20% of it to like the existing shareholders or Steve Mnuchin or someone like that. And that will do it. And you can do that in 180 days. So really all we're doing is changing the ownership of TikTok. We're not banning it. Against that are a large number of people who are saying, are you fucking kidding me? TikTok US is not a separate company. It doesn't even really exist right now. Trying to spin it up as a separate company would take more than 180 days on its own. Trying to sell anything and do a deal of this size would take more than 180 days. Like ByteDance is worth $250 billion and most of that is TikTok. So like very few people could afford it. Trying to do a, you know, a deal on the $100 billion range is not something that anyone is ever likely to be able to close in 180 days. And on top of all of that, it is extraordinarily unlikely that the Chinese government would ever let ByteDance do this in the first place. Add all that together, and the chances of TikTok actually being sold within 180 days are zero, which means that in practice, this bill acts as a ban and TikTok would disappear from our phones 180 days after it was, after the bill came into law. So that's, I think, the first big debate / question. Emily, do you think this is a, we just want to change the ownership bill, or do you think this is effectively a ban?
I think it's effectively a ban, but that doesn't mean that lawmakers want, like, they would be happy to change the ownership, but they don't care.
But they would rather see it banned than see a continuation of the status quo.
Yeah, I think so. They want the Chinese out of the social media platform. That's the goal. And they're apparently, at least in the House, probably not in the Senate, willing to do whatever it takes to make that happen.
There's an interesting comment from Alexis Ohanian, who founded Reddit, about this, where he suggested that part of the goal behind it was to force some reciprocity from the Chinese state, which doesn't allow U.S.-based social networks to really operate in state with, you know, the latitude and the freedom that they would like to. And so, it, you know, part of it, too, strategically is potentially about leverage and not really wanting an outright ban or really being afraid that, you know, the way a lot of legislators have put it, you know, are we going to give China our children's data?
which is a little bit of a red herring considering that you can already buy your kids' data from any number of legal information brokers.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely something happening here with policymakers and lawmakers like writ large and social media. We talked about this a little in an episode of What Next TBD that you can listen to after this if you want. But in addition to this ban in the House, there are these laws that they were just challenged at the Supreme Court passed in Florida and Texas that would give those states basically control over content moderation on the big social media platforms. And I mean, the Supreme Court's probably not going to let those laws stand, but there does seem to be like this big feeling amongst lawmakers right now, policymakers, of like trying to get like some kind of control over social media platforms writ large. This specific legislation is really about like fear of China, I think, and everyone's kind of like on board for that. And it kind of belongs to this general like need for decoupling that we've been talking about and seeing for the past few years. But it's also like combining with this sort of enlarged, increased fear of social media that's sort of overtaking legislators and lawmakers and everyone right now.
One of the things I wrote on Axios this week was a review of this new book by Frank McCourt, the business guy who used to own the LA Dodgers. And he has this extremely dystopian book out basically saying, yeah, that the big tech giants are destroying democracy and our lives and our humanity, and we've lost our humanity. And he has this rather batshit proposed solution to it called DSNP, which I will not bore you with. But I do think that you're right, that there's something that this tech clash, as it used to be known, has now made its way into, you know, the billionaire classes and into Congress. And this is something that didn't exist 4 years ago, right? Like 4 years ago, Trump tried to ban TikTok and basically got nowhere. We should mention, by the way, that there really is a mechanism for the US government to force ByteDance to divest TikTok. It's called CFIUS. TikTok is a rebranded version of an American app that ByteDance bought called Musical.ly. And when a foreign company buys a US company, like ByteDance buying Musical.ly, it goes to this thing called CFIUS, which stands for the Committee on Foreign Investment in the US. And CFIUS can basically force any of those deals to unwind. CFIUS looked at the Musical.ly acquisition when Trump was president and did nothing. And this is Congress basically second-guessing CFIUS and saying, you shouldn't have done nothing, you should have said no.
Well, CFIUS has been negotiating, or was supposed to be negotiating with TikTok behind the scenes, and TikTok had agreed to do all this stuff to make it more...
Well, they already did, right? They moved all the data center to Texas and gave Oracle a whole stake and all of that.
They're still working on that stuff. It is not done. The reporter I spoke to said it was like untangling spaghetti or something. It's harder than they made it seem. It's not over. Like, they were just, the whole process was moving really slowly and not to Congress's liking, like you said.
Also, Trump now opposes a TikTok ban because he has a big donor who's a billionaire investor in ByteDance.
Jeff Yass of Susquehanna.
But it was a little bit of like worst person you know makes good point, because he was like, if we shut down TikTok, it'll just be a win for Facebook. I mean, and then he called Facebook the enemy of the people, which I guess it's not the enemy of the people, of course. But shutting down TikTok probably would be good for Facebook, right?
I mean, but also, if you think about the major social networks, X is owned by Elon Musk, who's clearly been completely red-pilled. TikTok now, I mean, it's probably not going to happen, but it is now in the middle of a potential takeover bid by Steve Mnuchin, who, if you look at his public statements when he was working for Trump, was totally aligned with all MAGA principles. Facebook is owned and controlled by one man, Mark Zuckerberg, who, whatever else you say about him, is not a liberal. Like, he's definitely got right-ish/libertarian tendencies, and he spends a lot of time doing mixed martial arts. The ownership of the social networks is definitely tending towards...
going right.
It's tending towards the right. Yeah,
that's interesting. Sure. I hadn't really thought about it. But yeah, we lost Jack Dorsey and his beard and his like meditation and stuff.
Let's have a numbers round. Emily, what's your number?
My number is 1.5. That is the number of pounds in the precious honey glow, which is a small, tiny pineapple that was just created by Del Monte, because apparently pineapples, regular size ones, which are about twice the size of the 1.5 pounder, are too big for single person households. So in order to get people to continue to eat fresh pineapple, they had to engineer smaller pineapples.
So this is like pineapple for singles. And because it's small and adorable, more people will buy it.
Yeah.
Since this is another episode of Felix Recommends Stuff, Emily keeps on telling me that I should do this as a regular feature in Axios Markets.
Yeah, like Oprah's favorite things, but Felix.
Quite aside from Lancaster cast iron skillets and Sotarishi coffee mugs, the other like mastige, you know, like affordable luxury that you can buy is the pink glow pineapple, which is the most amazing thing in the world. It tastes like no pineapple you've ever had. It's incredibly delicious and it's pink.
Is it big? Is it a single person pineapple?
It's actually a little bit smaller than the regular pineapple. But if you splash out what is objectively a ludicrous amount of money to spend on a pineapple, but is in the grand scheme of things not so much money that you're ever going to really miss it, you will have an amazing experience.
I feel like they could have done a Barbie collaboration earlier. They totally should have done.
They should have put a pink glow pineapple in the Barbie movie somehow.
I really do support like single serving size fruits over big things like a pineapple, where once you cut it open, it's like, we got to eat pineapple for the next 4 days. You know what I mean? It's a good innovation. I want more of this.
Problem solution. We like it when that happens. Next All right. I'm Elizabeth. What's your number?
My number is 350,000. And that's about the number of Americans working in the furniture manufacturing industry right now. And the reason why this number is important is that it's down from around 700,000 in the year 2000. And the result of this is that if you've bought a sofa in the last 15 years, your sofa is probably garbage. And I learned this from a Dwell article that sort of explained that sofa quality went down precipitously when manufacturers realized that they could manufacture furniture much cheaper overseas, and they figured out logistics that would allow you to flat pack a sofa instead of having furniture movers physically move it and, you know, wrapped up and taken care of. And so now your sofa probably has substandard spring design, flimsy foam, and a lot of staples. And so you may want to just understand that if you bought a sofa recently and it really is garbage, if you take it to an upholsterer, they'll probably tell you that it's not even worth repairing and you should just buy a new sofa.
But the sofas are still expensive.
But maybe they're less expensive than they would have been if they hadn't offshored. I mean, it is a good question, right? I want to look out at the world out there and be like, what is an example of a manufactured good that generally increased in quality when manufacturing was offshored? I'm sure there are some. I feel like brassieres are one of them. I feel like we were very bad at making bras before they moved offshore, and now we're getting a little bit better. But like, I don't know. Write in slatemoney@slate.com. And no, because we've had this conversation on the show before, right?
About I don't know if it's bras, but I think clothes.
Bras are one of the few items of clothing that cannot be automated. Machines cannot make them. They all have to be made by hand. But yeah, write in if you can, like, in principle, if making a sofa is cheaper overseas, then you should be able to make a higher quality sofa for the same price. And instead, what seems to happen is you wind up with a lower quality sofa for the same price. And that's an interesting thing that I think we should have a segment about, but we can only have a segment if you write in with examples of what are examples of manufactured goods that improved in quality after they got offshored. My number is 691,000, which is the number of dollars, or I should not say dollars, but rather USDCs, which is circles, I think they're called. Anyway, they're a stable coin. They're a crypto dollar. It's the number of crypto dollars that has been pledged to something called WIF on Sphere. WIF is a crypto meme coin called Dog With Hat, which is basically a dog wearing a hat. And the WIF community, because they do these kind of things, has raised $691,000 to put Dog With Hat on the Sphere in Las Vegas for a day. And so the Sphere in Las Vegas is going to have a dog with a hat on it for a day, because just for the memes.
Fun. There crypto is really back, is it not? I mean, I know it's not 2021 again, but things are happening.
Bitcoin is at a record high. We have all. It looks very much, Emily, I hate to admit this, but it looks like you're going to win our bet about the ETFs. So, yeah, we'll find out in January. But, like, the number has been ticking up towards 5% quite fast. And I do anticipate that it will pass that 5% mark, and then I will lose the bet.
Aw, I'm sorry.
You're not that sorry.
Not that sorry.
I was going to have to buy some crypto. At which point, I think we shall wrap it up for this week, unless you are one of our lovely, beautiful, talented, thin, tanned Slate Plus members. You get to listen to Shayna Rupp talking about tanning, which apparently is back. So that's coming up in Slate Plus. Otherwise, thanks to Shayna, not only for coming on Slate Plus, but also for producing the show. Thanks for Jared Downing for also producing the show. And we will be back on Tuesday with the nerdiest and most amazing podcast I have recorded in years. I have recorded a whole big long podcast with the Jay Newman. You may have heard of Elliot versus Argentina, the big fight, court fight over Argentina's defaulted debt. He was the Elliot in Elliot versus Argentina, basically. And he doesn't talk in public very often, so this is one you're going to want to tune in for. So that's coming up on Tuesday, and then we're back on Saturday with a regular Slate Money.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.